So today's date is the
14th, I think. Yesterday was the 13th.
Oh, yeah.
the 14th of June.
2011.
Correct.
And this is the Pioneers of the Fringe project. And who am I interviewing today? Your full name?
Frances Pauline Petkovic, née Curac.
And your address, where this interview is taking place?
At 2 Dixon Road, Denham Court, New South Wales.
What are your parents' full names?
Anton Curac and Perina Curac. And she was the only Perina I knew for 50 years. And then I met an Italian lady who was Perina.
So your date of birth and your place of birth?
24th of December 1937 in the village of Žrnovo on the island of Korčula, the former Yugoslavia. Now Croatia.
Can you describe that village for us?
I can describe it, not as a child, but as grown up going back to visit. It's a smallish village, a matter of a number of hundred people, I would say. It's in four sort of little inter-villages to make the one village of Žrnovo. And Mum came from one sector and Dad came from the other sector. And Mum says that the good-looking girls were in her area and the good-looking boys were in Dad's area.
That was lucky, wasn't it?
Yes.
Do you know your parents' date of birth?
Yes, Dad was born on the 27th of October 1910 and Mum was born on the 6th of October 1912.
We're doing your history today, but we'll be reflecting on your parents' histories as well.
Right.
Because you'll be talking on their behalf, really, won't you?
Yes.
What did your parents do in Korčula? Like, what was your father's trade?
My dad was a monumental stonemason. He was a very good one. Every time I go overseas, I go to the cathedral in Korčula, in the main town, and he did the pulpit in the cathedral, and I go and sit and just look at it and feel closer to him. Mum was, like most of the women, out in the fields, and although she did have a job replanting pines through all the forest area on Korčula for the council. And she did that for a number of years until the family stopped, more or less, and she just did the field work.
Do you remember? What do you remember as a child?
Over there, nothing. I was 2 years and 4 months old when we arrived in Australia. I can't recall anything. With my two brothers and Mum. Dad had come out in 1937. He was in Australia 3 months before I was born, so we didn't meet until I was 2 years and 4 months old. Instant love.
So can you tell me your father, who was a stonemason, and he migrated here. Do you know what boat he migrated on?
On the Roma. I do know that because he had the care of a young 12-year-old boy that was coming out from another village. They put him in his care, and I'd never asked Dad while he was alive, but I asked Ivan before he died on what ship they came, and he told me it was the Roma. And that was 1937 in October. I'm not too certain what date.
What did he do when he arrived here?
Dad came, his cousin brought him out here. He came out, he owed £60 and he had 2 shillings in his pocket when he arrived. He went to work as a stonemason, just making fences and all that around Wurrunga and everywhere else. But at that time, doesn't matter how good a mason you were, I hate to say it, but it's the way it was, an Anglo-Saxon came asking for a job and didn't even know how to handle his tools, Dad got sacked and he got the job. And he was working quite a bit at... we were living in Leichhardt at that time. He was working quite a bit out at Palm Beach, so he'd get a threepenny bus fare, go halfway to Palm Beach. He'd get off the bus with a bag of tools, a Hessian bag of tools on his back, take his shoes and socks off and walk the rest of the way barefooted so that he wouldn't wear his shoes out. But that's all he could afford was the threepence.
So you first... So he was working as a stonemason. When did your family follow?
We followed... We arrived in Australia on the 20th of April, 1940. It was the last Italian ship to reach Sydney. Two more arrived in Fremantle and were taken over for troop transport. My parents told me, I've never looked it up, I suppose I could now on the internet, that our ship went from Sydney, Brisbane, Cairns, dropping off, and then went via Singapore, was stopped at Singapore by the British because of the war, and asked to hand over the ship. The captain didn't. He got all his people off the ship, and then it was bombed and sunk to the bottom of the ocean because he wouldn't hand it over to the British. That's what I was told, so I hope it's right.
So, and your family, he was in Leichhardt?
Yes, when he came, because his cousin was in Leichhardt that brought him out here. But then the war, of course, started, and they started taking people in, call up. They called up Dad to go to the war. And he acted a little silly, so he took me with him out to Victoria Barracks at Paddington. And the chappie there said, right, the next call up you get, you come without the child. But my mum was very ill and my brother was very ill. And if he wasn't around, I presume we would have lost both of them. And he packed up. Didn't leave a forwarding address. We went to Blacktown to some friends, and this farm next door was being sold, and with his brother-in-law and a friend, they put £75 down on the farm and bought it. And so when the next call-up came, they couldn't find him. And when they finally found him, he was a farmer. The land had been transferred over, and then he worked for the war effort. Everything he grew on the farm went to the army, which was out at...
Holsworthy or
Inverburn? No, out at... out on... Walgrove. Because that was the front where all the soldiers usually came there, and from there went to the front, up in New Guinea and the Pacific and wherever it was that they were going to. They left from there. And he used to have to take all his foodstuffs up there. Didn't make a lot of money, but at least he was home with us. He was getting paid. They were paying off slowly the farm.
So can I what was the illness that your mum had?
Mum, when she came here, because on the farm, she got she worked all day on the farm, and at night she'd do all the housework, whatever it was, and the washing. Now, the washing was done in the laundry outside of, which was a different building. You had to stoke up the old copper and boil everything. And during the winter, she was down there boiling the clothes, washing it, taking it out onto the long lines, not the Hills hoist, and putting it there. And she got double pneumonia. And nearly died then, and my eldest brother had gotten rheumatic fever when he was still in Yugoslavia. He'd fallen into a well in the middle of winter and nearly drowned. A perfectly healthy baby, but that happened when he was 5 years old. And so I can recall Mum being in one hospital for 6 months and Tom being in another one for 6 months, and Dad we had an old gentleman looking after my other brother and myself. And Dad just going from one hospital to the other. You know, this one's dying there, that one's dying there.
Unbelievable stress.
Oh, unbelievable, yes. And not only that, the thing is that he was never, ever told that there were things that he could get from the government. Never told. and every doctor's visit were in the guineas at that time, and he was just, and no medical cover, but you had to pay for everything, and he was really, as you said, stressed.
So at Blacktown, so what, your mum got well?
She'd get better. Yeah. That the first time she went to Balmain Hospital, then she was out to the Women's Hospital at Paddington, then she was out to Rachel Foster at Redfern, then back again to Paddington, backwards and forwards. So Dad always told me a story about when he arrived at Balmain Hospital. Mum was... it was a big room. It wasn't a private room or a four-bed or a two-bed, but there were about 8 or 10 women in the ward, and that the nurses were taking bets on who was going to die, mum or the lady next door to her. And they got the priest to mum, and Dad happened to be there. And he said, well, I don't know whether it's just figuratively speaking, that he gave him a kick up the rear end and told him to get lost, that if she saw him that she'd get frightened and she really would die. And she slowly got better, but she had terrible scarred arms where they were giving her sulfuranamide because there was no penicillin or anything like that, and the arms just swelled up and they had to cut them open to get her everything out. And Dad just said, just pour the medications in her, just keep pouring it, because I've got one sick boy and two little kids at home.
So what do you recall about that time as a little girl?
I mostly recall Dad waking me up during the night to kiss me and ask me how I am. I mostly recall this elderly gentleman taking care of us. He was a real funny old, gorgeous old gentleman. And just playing with my brother.
And what were you eating then?
Uncle Ivan cooked mostly like Mum did, you know, the really mostly soups to say on bones, not on meat, but bones and veggies. Then one night he made some soup and went to put some pepper in it. This one I recall very well, and the whole pepper thing went in, and instead of getting a spoon and taking it out, he quickly stirred it, thinking it was so when Dad came home about midnight or whatever it was and tried the soup, it burnt his mouth out. Anyhow, he didn't say anything to anybody, but a few weeks later Uncle Ivan had false teeth, and he used to put him in a glass of water every night. And Uncle Ivan got up in the morning and washed his teeth and put them in his mouth and started spitting and spitting and spitting, and he was spitting for 3 or 4 days. Dad had changed the water and put kerosene in it. So his teeth were in kerosene all night long. They played tricks on each other.
And what sort of food was your father growing?
Dad grew, well, when we came to the farm, there were other families from Corktula living at Blacktown.
Can you remember some of their names?
Yes, the Poses, the Billises, the Batistiches, the Shegardins, the different Shegardin families, the Billish family had 2 or 3 brothers, sort of thing. There was another Curac family, they had 2 daughters who I was very close to. The Yerichiviches, we were very close to each other, because at that time we were still foreigners. We weren't really clasped to the bosom of everyone else, although we had some fabulous neighbours, absolutely fabulous. I know about the second day that we got to the farm, this is all that I'm not that I recall. I can recall the farmhouse. I can recall the wind blowing through the wood. It was a real old farmhouse, but Dad fixed it up. We had an Italian neighbour at one end that had a dairy farm. A couple of days after arriving there, he comes along with this anemic-looking cow with big udders, and he introduced himself, and because Mum and Dad could both speak some Italian, they got on quite well. And he said, "I've bought you this cow. You've got a lot of grass here. You milk it, you use the milk, and let her eat the grass. And when she fattens up, I'll take her away and I'll bring you another one." And this was all through our life on the farm at Blacktown. We never bought a cow, but we always had milk. And then Mr. and Mrs. Mansfield, they were an old English couple. They had chickens and ducks and that. A couple of days after arriving, here he comes with this big box. I can remember that, of all these baby chickens and little ducks, and said, "You know, you need something here. Here are these, grow them up." And so Dad had to quickly make a cage of some description, and there were old sheds on the property, but he had to close them off. And then within 6 weeks, we had chickens and ducks to eat. And Tom, I can remember, my oldest brother, always making traps for birds. We ate a lot of birds. And not that I'd eat them now, but I can't even look at a quail. And Dad immediately, I mean, it took a while, but once the garden was going, then we had plenty of greens. There was the spinach, there was the Yugoslav cabbage, the tall one. There was always lettuce, there was always onions, cabbages, everything. But the main thing that he grew was the tomatoes. And he did those, and three crops a year. And when the one allotted finish, he'd take the tomatoes out, so that he could reuse the manure and everything else there. He'd put in either onions or cabbages, and then he had sort of like three different crops growing in the one soil. And then he'd leave that plot alone for a couple of years and lime it and let it rest and go elsewhere. But I can remember Mum and Dad with the horses pulling out trees, cutting them down, pulling them out.
Ploughs and chains.
Yes, ploughs and chains. And
where did they get the horses from? They probably borrowed them, did they?
No, I think he must have bought. And Peter and Mary, beautiful old draft horses. They were so... Peter could pull this house if he wanted to, but put him behind a plough and he went berserk. And Dad made a sled, and we used the sled for bringing everything, you know, to the wherever the garden was at the time. I loved the horses, and I used to go and swing off their tail between their legs, and both of them would lie down so I could get on top of them and walk around the farm on them. They were fabulous. And yet this old gentleman that took care of us, and he'd say to Dad, "Tom, what's my job today?" And Dad'd say, "Oh, how about Uncle Ivan? You go down and you saddle the horses, get them all ready for the sled." "Oh no, not me." And so I'd go and get them, and I was only small. I absolutely adored them. And then Peter fell into a creek across the bottom of the farm. And he fell in with his hind legs into a hole, must have broken his hind legs, and he died. And Mary, I think, went of old age.
So what year are we talking about here? Is this after the war?
We're talking here about 1940, let's say 44, 45, 46, up to about 48.
Do you remember what street was your property on?
The address was... RMB 1087 Walters Road, Blacktown.
And how big was the property?
25 acres.
And do you remember how much your Dad paid for it?
They put £75 on it, so I think it must have been about £750. And that was in 1942, because you had to put 10%, or was it 20%? I'm not too certain. But anyhow, he bought his two partners out. Later on, and we stayed on the farm, and one went back to Yugoslavia to his family, and my uncle bought a property in Bungaribi Road and settled there until he bought his family out.
So how are you going?
I'm going well.
Good. You said you are going well. So do you How long was your father farming the land for?
From 1942 to 1956, when we he in a peak, he got so upset, he picked two boxes of tomatoes off the crop, and it was a fabulous, beautiful crop. He was looking at a really good, and the prices were right. And in the afternoon, the weather turned, and we got hailstorms. Terrible hailstorm, and not a hailstorm fell across the fence on the property next door that had nothing, but came straight down the fence line of our property. The tomatoes and even the steaks were all. It was like a tractor had gone through, and there was nothing, absolutely nothing left, because the storm went down and then came back again. I remember it smashed Mum and I were at the kitchen window. It smashed the windows. It smashed the. We didn't have tiles on the roof. We had slate, and it smashed a lot of slate tiles on the roof. The water was pouring in everywhere. It was a terrible storm. The next morning, it was a Sunday. The next morning, Dad got up, got dressed, and Mum said, "Where are you going?" He says, "I'm going into Sydney to sell the farm." And she said, "Don't be ridiculous." He went into Sydney, and within a week it was sold. And then Mum was upset. She was terribly, terribly upset. She loved it there, and she wanted to stay there, but Dad said he'd just had it.
So... Well, you talked to me earlier about your father making chicken cages.
He didn't make the chicken cages. He got chickens in cages. A gentleman in Blacktown had started doing that, and then Dad thought, oh, well, that's much easier. He was a friend of Dad's. That's much easier than just being out in the garden. So he built these two huge chicken sheds and had the cages, and then we put the chickens in. I think there are about 2,000 chickens in each shed. Around that, so and then he had the eggs.
Do you know who he was supplying?
The egg board. Everything went to the egg board. You didn't sell privately. You did to a friend's or that, you know, broken eggs or that, but all the eggs went to the chick to the egg board at the time.
What sort of chickens were they?
Oh, just white, just the ordinary white ones. And then you got sick and tired of them because they're in an enclosed area, and if when one chicken had a, let's say, a large egg and she had a bit of blood on her bottom, the other chickens would start picking at her, and before you knew it, within 24 hours, everything was hanging out and you had to... They're cannibals, absolute cannibals, the chickens are. And I got so sick of them. I used to know how to go along and just screw their neck. Sometimes I'd screw the one that was with her that was still healthy because I'd get so cranky.
So what was your role there? Like, you would have supported your family a lot of
them. Oh, yes. When we were small, when we had the early crop, which they call, is the, now at this time, under bags.
So let's talk about the crop, okay, so can we go through, there's three lots of crops, are
yes,
there?
Yes, yeah.
Do you mind just going over those, and talking about the food production itself, so in winter?
Yeah, in winter, this is what they always call the early crop, and it usually flowered just around, for Christmas, New Year, for the summer salads, but they were under bags. And every morning, my brother and I, before we went to school, we'd have to run down and open up the bag so the sun had come to the... And every night when we came home after school, we'd have to go and close them. That was part of our job until, of course, the plants got too high for the bags, and then Dad did them.
But so what time would you get out? How long would that take, and how many plants were there?
Oh, he never had under 2,500 plants, never, sometimes 3, 4, 5, depends. During the summer, the later crop that came, let's say, in March, April, the crop, then he'd put in more because they didn't need bags and they didn't, it was summery. The only thing was that the water supply wasn't very good, so Mum and Dad used to, under a lantern, kerosene lantern they used to go and water during the night when there was a bit better supply of water for the summer crop. And then they'd put one in around February. No, hang on, that was the one in around July, August, whatever it is, August. One just before Christmas, and then, yeah, and one in about 4 months difference. So they were
what
different.
So the steaks were ordered, were they? They didn't go...
At first, the steaks, they used to go up Currajong and pick all the steaks from the, mostly from wattle trees. They were the best ones. They'd go up there for a couple of days onto different farms. They had permission, and they'd go and they'd pick all these steaks. But then later on, they got, well, in, let's say, in Blacktown, old Mr. Wells started a timber yard, and they bought them off him. So they didn't have to go and cut them. But it was quite a day out to go up into the bush.
Did you go?
I went only once, but being small, Dad couldn't do that much work because I kept wandering away. And so, well, not exactly small, I was 5 or 6, I suppose, but you keep a little child in the one spot, you can't. So he didn't take me anymore.
Was he part of a co-op or anything?
No, Blacktown didn't have a co-op, didn't. No, everybody was by themselves. And
did you know other people from other communities?
Yes.
From South West, did you?
Oh, yes. We used to come out here to Leppington or out to Care. A lot of them lived at Canley Vale at the time, at Cabramatta. We used to go to Narrabeen, Warriwood especially, and visit all. We were a very close-knit community. They had the Club Zora in Sydney. They'd go down there, they'd meet there, and then when they could get away, they'd sort of go and visit each other. It was a day out. It was wonderful, really terrific days out. And at Blacktown, when we were there, especially during the winter months, everybody had come to, let's say, our place one Sunday afternoon, and then the next Sunday afternoon we'd go to someone else's place, and then someone else's place again. And before we had the Dad had the truck, had to walk it. And I do recall being on Dad's shoulders while we were walking through the bush to get to someone else's place, and across creeks and all this for miles. We'd go for miles, but it didn't matter. We had fun doing it. It was wonderful.
So thinking of the equipment that you started with on the farm, your father's equipment, it would have been pretty basic, of course.
Nothing but hand tools, the hoe, the rake, the axe, the tomahawk, the plough, and I can recall like a rotary hoe plough type of thing that we had for the horses. Nothing really, everything was done by hand. Everything.
So when did
and no, we didn't have any grass poisons or anything like that you could kill off the grass. You had that. That was all weeded out of the by hand.
And what about deep spraying fertilisers and things?
At that time, they usually went out to a dairy farm, and they bought back a truckload, or you bought a truckload of manure. It was they'd go to a poultry farm, and they'd mix the cow manure and the poultry manure. None of the they had blood and bone. I can recall that when they wanted the tomatoes to come on quick, they'd quickly get some blood and bone to give them a spurt. Mostly everything was DDT. We didn't have that many bugs. The DDT got rid of everything.
So how was that prepared? Do you remember how...
Oh, and hang on, Dad used to get the bluestone. That's right, the bluestone, and he'd melt it in a big barrel. I've got a photo of a barrel, and then he'd put it on a knapsack.
So what is bluestone? I have no idea.
Bluestone is it's also a for the garden. It kills a certain amount of bugs. It's a bit like a sulfur, a type of sulfur. But you had to melt it. It'd stay for days in the water, and you'd have to stir it every so often and melt it. And then he'd pour it into his knapsack and go along and spray the tomatoes or whatever it is. And Mum, of course, her flowers. She had a lot of flowers around the house, her pride and joy.
So what did she grow? What type of flowers?
Oh, just the ordinary garden. What they call it, a cottage garden type of thing nowadays. Whatever turned out, to tell you the truth, you'd pinch a bit here, or someone would give you a couple of seeds there. Not that they bought any. And she had a green thumb at everything would sprout with her.
And who supplied your dad with the tomato seeds? Do you know who the suppliers or the agents were?
No. He grew them himself. Mostly at first, and then later on I know they did get them supplied, but at first you had the seeds and you put them in seedling boxes. Although he had them made like a long, like a chicken coop type of thing with the boxes, and then grew the seeds, and when they got to a certain, then into the ground. That was the first lot that I recall, but afterwards they had us suppliers that made it a lot easier for them.
So you grew crops for,
yes,
and you had chicken sheds.
Yes, later on, not at the same time.
So
now, Dad had chicken. I think Dad put the chicken sheds in about in the 1950, 51, something like that.
Do you recall when you got your first tractor?
Never had a tractor.
Never had a tractor.
No, never had a tractor. I used to get a contractor in later on.
So but poor, never. Really poor.
Yes. Yes, definitely poor. One of the biggest things that my brother and I could even think about, and we spoke about it all up until he died, was how wonderful it was for Christmas to get a bottle of lemonade each. That was our present. Yeah, but we did have plenty of milk, and we had milkshakes. Mrs. Mansfield came up and she showed Mum how to churn butter, how to make cheese, cream. Then she told her about the milkshakes, and Dad couldn't get any of the flavours except at the markets. And he bought the, and I'm crazy about caramel. He got the caramel and the strawberry. And we had the milkshakes, and she showed her how to make ice cream. So, I mean, in that way, we were very, very well off. And then this other lady came along and showed her, because she'd never made a cake in her life while she was overseas. They were really poor over there. And she came along and she showed the neighbours, as I said, were wonderful, absolutely wonderful. Showed her how to make cakes and all this. She knew how to make the Yugoslav, the little, what we call prosciutto, and like a little, the centre of the doughnut, as some of my son's children used to say, friends, and the crostoli, she made those. But this lady came and she showed her how to make all these different sort of cakes, so we had, you know, and she would return the favour by taking tomatoes to them, by taking onions or cabbage or whatever it was. She'd repay them in different ways, whatever was on the garden, on the farm.
So when you talk about your neighbours, it's not like suburbia, is it?
So no,
can you
no.
describe the landscape, and how far away were they?
Well, our next door neighbour, the one closest to us, would have been about 200 metres away, the house on another farm. Our farm went from Walters Road to Reservoir Road. And the farm on the left-hand side was a double farm. They had just 12 and a half acres up top, 12 and a half acres down the bottom, and there was a Mr. Pozza down the bottom. The farm on the other side of us was a large farm. He had 7 or 8 horses, which I was allowed to ride at any time. But he had a lot of land, and he must have been at least a kilometre away. Down on Walters Road, we had an Italian family whose daughter was one of the daughters. He had 6 daughters and 1 son. He said he wasn't going to stop having children until he had his son, so he was seven. And then we had two Maltese neighbours on either side of Walters Road, who were wonderful. And then next to them was, as I said, Mrs. Mansfield with a big poultry farm. And this is she was a kilometre away. So, I mean, no one was getting anyone's hair, and there was a lot of bush between everyone.
So did you have a horse and cart?
No, we didn't have a horse and cart. We had feet.
You had two legs.
Yes. We had feet. We had to walk. I know when I started school at Blacktown, we walked 2.5 miles to go to school and back home. And then just, I should imagine it would have been about 19... I think we walked for about 2 years when I started school. So when I started when I was six, it means it was 43. About 45, there was this big old black car, be it an Oldsmobile or Pontiac or something, and he used to collect us kids on the on Walters Road, and we were packed in like sardines, and he'd take us to school, and that was for a couple of years. And then we got a bus service in the late 40s. In the morning, it was very quick to get to school because he'd come down Walters Road and into Blacktown. But coming home, the bus did a big circle. We went from Blacktown Station right along Flushcombe Road, along the Great Western Highway out to Eastern Creek, back again, and then down on Walters Road. We were amongst the last to get out at that time. That'd take well over an hour or something to get home in the bus, but fun, because all the kids were on there.
So what did you do for play? How did you play? What games did you play?
Cricket, football, sling shots, bows and arrows. We made our own. I didn't play with girls. I played with my brothers and their friends, and to tell you the truth, they used to pick me first, who was picking a side.
Far more entertaining, isn't it?
It is, isn't it? Mm. Yeah, and throwing knives at bandicoots, not that we knew they were you know, it were terrible. We used to kill everything that was on the farm.
Did you?
Yes.
Describe a bit of that killing.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I mean, we'd either with the bow and arrow or my brothers were pretty good
throwing. Plenty of wildlife.
Yes, there was a lot of wildlife and rabbits and...
So can you describe it a bit, like...
Well, down in the creek is where most of the bandicoots were. We thought they were big rats. We didn't know they were bandicoots. And I do recall a lot of spiders, of course, in the trees and hanging down. And I was scared of spiders. Then there's the snakes. And then we had a huge guana on one of the trees. We used to go and throw rocks at it, being kids. And then it'd get into the water and we couldn't see it and wait for us to go away. Of course, as I said, snakes, all sorts of snakes. And I've got a piece of furniture downstairs that's still got a big mark on it where I started screaming. I'd stood on a brown snake with my foot and it came up. And I started screaming, and Dad was sitting at the table still having lunch. He told me to go down and have a look at the chickens, see if they were. It was a very hot day. And as he threw his chair back, it slammed into the sideboard and chipped it, and rushed down with a. And he knew immediately that when I was screaming that it must have been a snake with his axe, and chopped its head off. But you know, just. It was wild. It was still wild.
But you weren't feral, were you?
No. Oh, no. Crikey's no. Oh, no. Mum was a lovely lady. She was a real lady.
And I'm interested in your response to the chickens and the chicken shed and how you disliked it.
Well, the thing is, they, as I said before, they were cannibals. And on a hot day, as I said, they'd start picking at each other, and having you had the cages back to back and on the side. So I mean, the only way a chicken could sort of get away was if she faced where the eggs rolled off. But I mean, chickens don't have brains, and she just kept they'd just move around. So you had the chickens at the back picking at her, the chickens at the side picking at her, and until they practically killed it. And you'd feel so sorry for the animal, and you had to kill it. That was all there was to it. But I'd get so cranky at the one with it that I'd screw its neck and then take it up to Mum, and we'd get the old copper boiling, and then we'd clean it up. We had plenty of chicken. We had plenty of, we had Kentucky chicken before even Kentucky chicken was thought of out here.
Mum, so you used to cut the chicken's heads off and pluck them and stuff?
Yes, yeah.
Like nothing, would it?
Nothing, no. I didn't. I was even telling my little granddaughter the other day, I said, nothing about it. Go down, chop it, that's it. Put it in a big tin, one of those kerosene tins, yeah.
Let's talk about that, like we're preparing the chicken. Like, just pretend that this is a...
Right, you'd get your... We never ever killed more... at least two, unless we had a lot of visitors, and then there were a whole lot of them. But we'd kill two, and because Mum, out of the older one, she'd make soup. It was good for soup. And then she'd make a type of crumb chicken, and she'd bake one, the younger one. You'd get them. You'd get a block of wood. I had the tomahawk, not the axe. It was too heavy. Put the head on the block. Off it goes, and you immediately put it in one tin. Because once you cut the head off, if you don't have it secure, it's going to jump everywhere. And I know once my brother cut one but didn't cut it properly, and this rooster's running around the farm with its head hanging off but still breathing. And it took us a while to catch it. So, and then you do that until it stops jumping around inside the tin. Then you'd go up to the copper with the water boiling. You'd put it into the boiling water for a couple of moments, holding it by the legs. Then you'd pluck it. And after you've plucked all the big ones, there's a tiny little feathers, a very, very fine ones. And you'd get some newspaper, and you'd set it alight, and you'd hold it by the legs, and you'd burn off these tiny little... hairs that were on it, and then into the laundry tub, and you cut it open. But you had to be very, very careful that you didn't cut the gallbladder on it. You had to pull that out, because if the gallbladder opened up, then the whole chicken was soured. It was no good at all. And you cleaned it, and that was it.
And did the offal go anywhere? Or?
Yes, into the garden. Got buried. Everything got buried. Because at that time we didn't have sewerage or even nothing. We just had the old dummy out the back. So everything got buried into the area of garden that wasn't going to be used for a couple of years.
And that worked quite well, didn't
it? Oh, yes. Yes, yes. By the time you came back to the garden, there was nothing, absolutely nothing there. The worms had done their work perfectly.
So, how do you feel about chicken today?
Oh, I eat a lot of it. I'm not like Evita. She won't even touch it. But it doesn't work.
Understandably for her.
Yes. No. I love chicken. I do it in a whole heap of different ways. To tell you the truth, I even prefer it more to meat nowadays.
Okay. Well, thanks for that bit on the chicken. That was interesting. So what school did you go to?
Well, I went to St. Patrick's. I started at St. Patrick's at Blacktown. It was run by nuns. It didn't have a school. It had a church. And it had, I can recall this, heavy velvet curtains which came across from the altar rail up and down. The school was all different classes. We were all in different classes in the rest of the church. Then they built a couple of little rooms on the side of the church, and we had school there. But at fourth class, I only went there until third class. At fourth class, I went to Our Lady of Mercy at Parramatta, which was very expensive. But my dad believed in good education, And the better the education, the easier the life for later on, because he only went to second class. But a self-taught man, he did everything. The only thing he couldn't do was multiply. He couldn't work, and division. He couldn't work out how to work that. I tried to teach him, but it just didn't gel. But he could add and all that. He knew that terrific. Learned to read English by himself, and spoke English very well. Mum didn't; she was on the farm most of the time. And once.
So when did your father leave the farm?
We left the farm in 1956.
Oh, so after he left the farm, he learnt English.
No, he knew it before, because when he came here, he only stayed with his cousin in 1937. He only stayed for weeks with his cousin, and then his cousin placed him in a family, and there was the mother and two daughters. They were an Australian family, and he didn't know a word of English. So he was there, and they'd say, if he wanted a glass, he'd get up and get a glass, and the lady of the house would say, no, that is a glass. You asked me for a glass. And the daughters and she taught him English very well. It was a matter of having to. He couldn't stay there if he didn't know anything. And many years later, a car stopped at my brother's garage in Liverpool, and she saw the name Kurak, and they came in, and my brother happened to be there one day, and they said, Kurak, are you any relation to Anton Kurak? And Maurice said, yes, I'm his son. He says, well, your father lived with us when he came out from Yugoslavia in 1938, 39, 40.
What was their name again?
I don't know. Okay. I don't know their name. Maury was he was so excited. He didn't ask their name. He didn't ask for their telephone number, and we never ever saw them again.
What a beautiful moment, though.
Yes, it was. He came running. He got into his car and came straight up the highway to Mum and told her. And he says, "Well, why didn't you?" She said, "Why didn't you bring them up here? We'd have had tea and coffee, and there was always cakes in the house, and we could have had a really wonderful." Mum, I didn't think. I was so excited.
So, how was your school experience as a migrant?
Well, it gave me a backbone. If I wasn't called a bloody dago at least three or four times a day, it wasn't a good day.
It does make it stronger, doesn't it?
Yes. I always, I'm upset with my husband. He gets to be called a new Australian coming out here in 1956, and yet I was always called a bloody dago. Which made us all stronger, I think, and I think it was terrific.
Who were some of your friends at school?
A lot of Australian lasses, of course. One of my biggest friends was Jean Mansfield and Gillian Beggs.
So Mansfield was a neighbour, is that the neighbour?
The niece of the neighbour, which lived further, about another kilometre up the road. Yeah. And Therese Rubo, she was very, very close.
Name seems familiar.
Yes, her uncle used to bring the cow to us. He had the dairy farm.
And is that where you learned to speak English predominantly, or were you speaking
at school?
English?
At school, yes, we're speaking English. And as I was going to say, we were sitting on the back veranda once, and we were trying to teach Mum some words of English. And Dad was listening around the corner, we didn't know. And he came around, and he was very, very upset. And he told us that we were not to speak English in the house, that what he and Mum learnt, they would learn, that we would learn English, that we'd be going to school here, that we'd know it perfectly, and that we were to speak Yugoslav in the house and with Mum, because if we couldn't speak to her properly, what were we going to do? Start braying like a donkey to each other. And therefore, when Maury and I came home, because we were close, my oldest brother was 7 years older, We were 2 years apart. When we'd come home and halfway across the steps leading onto the veranda, we'd change from English to Yugoslav. And in the house, it was all Yugoslav.
But did you dream in English or Yugoslav?
I very rarely dream, so I don't. The few dreams that I had, I wouldn't know what they were in.
So there were some photographs of you in, I don't know if it was a beauty pageant or what.
No. I represented, usually represented Yugoslavia at all the international balls and anything that went on with the diplomatic corps here in Sydney. And
talk about that a bit.
Yes, yeah. I was. I don't know. I just.
How did you get involved in that? What happened at that start?
Well, I
was
working.
Were you drop dead gorgeous, or what happened? Did you have to look a particular way, or?
I don't know. I think we were quite good looking. I had gorgeous hair. That much I did. Not now, but then I did. No, we were, as I said before, a close community. And the Yugoslav consul here used to go to the Club Zora, where it was down in Sydney, where everybody met up and that. And got very close to Dad, all of them, because they all used to come out onto the farm to get, predominantly, I would say, to get fresh vegetables and have some of Mum's coffee and soup. This is where, as I said before, that I'd learned to screw the necks of chickens, because all these people had come up, and the quickest way to make a meal was go down and get all these chickens and clean them up, and then Mum did the rest. One of the consul generals here wanted me to, because I was doing secretarial work in the city, to be his secretary. And he'd sent a taxi for me at lunchtime to come down, and they were at Rushcutters Bay at the time, to come down there, and he'd talk to me, and then I'd go home again that night and I'd talk to Dad. Dad would have loved for me to work for him, but at the time there was a lot of unrest in the community. We had a lot of people coming out from the after the war that were absolutely what we'd call today's terrorists. I had to walk from the road up to the house through the bush to get to their house, and they were out at Rooty Doonside and Wargrove at the camps there. And he said, no, I don't want you to work there. He says, anyone could be waiting for you in the bush and slit your throat and that. And as I said, at that time, if you go through, you find that they were throwing bombs in Sydney, and there was a terrible unrest, and that was one of the reasons why I didn't go work for him. But he persisted for years, tried to get me to go and work, but I didn't.
So,
being that sort of close to them, then, as I said, every time they had something on or cocktail parties and all this, I would go,
Who would attend these parties?
Well, the International War was the complete diplomatic corps from everywhere. Then at different parties, it might have been people that were coming here from Yugoslavia for the government, like you get presidents coming today and that, whoever was, you know, they'd come out here and then they'd have these parties, and then I'd be there and with them. I had a wonderful time.
Yeah, I'm sure you would. Yes. Be very exciting. No wonder you want to live in the city. any memories, I guess, distinct memory about a particular time at a party, or just an anecdote? Or...
Well, great. Just absolutely great.
Yeah.
The only thing was getting home, of course. So at that time, I was, let's say, I left school at 16, so that would have been between 17, 18, 19. My eldest brother had a car, so he'd drive me in and drive me back home to Blacktown, because there were no trains. It stopped at 1 o'clock in the morning. The 1 o'clock Parramatta, not 1 o'clock Sydney, but 1 o'clock at Parramatta, and we had no way to get home. So there used to be about 10 of us in a taxi.
Oh,
if we miss the train. That was the downside of everything. But otherwise, no, we had a absolutely fantastic. We made our own fun. We did our own things. Let's say during winter now, we all sat around the fuel stove. The dad would be reading, mum would be mending. I had to do fancy work, or mum would be. I've got so many tablecloths fancy worked. The boys would be playing drafts, listening to the old gramophone records. Tom, my eldest brother, decided to learn how to dance, and at 17, I was 10. So he'd come home the next night and he'd draw the markings on mum's lino floor. He'd put the gramophone on and off he'd go with me. So I was a fabulous dancer by the time I was ready to go out, and I loved dancing. So I learnt all these fancy steps and all the best ways, you know, and
the foxtrot,
the samba, the English waltz, the waltz, the everything.
How marvellous.
As I said, I think I had a much better time growing up than what my own children did. They're all into their TV, their games, not that mine had them. They got TV when coloured when Anton became Ducks of the School. That was his present. And a colour TV. We had black and white in 1957.
So, okay, can we just... So you moved as a family from Blacktown in 56?
Yes. We moved while Dad had bought this 5-acre farm at Casula.
So I don't want to miss the romance with your husband yet. Yeah. So had you met your husband yet?
No.
Okay, no. So don't forget this. We've got to...
Right, no. My cousin came out. My cousin was in camp in Italy with my husband.
Uh-huh.
My cousin came to us in 1955, November 55. They came out on the ship together. But Miles went to a friend of his parents at Chatswood. He stayed there for a couple of weeks and then flew to Cairns and had a fire on board when he flew to Cairns. They went out into the bush somewhere. They had to let it go down. And then I met him when he came back to Sydney on a dare. Another friend of mine had been writing to him, and she kept saying that she was going to marry him, you know, and because her neighbour was my girlfriend here in living in Kookaburra Road, Preston's. And we both, Margaret and I, said, well, look, let's see if we can get him away from Olga, whoever he is, you know.
Oh, I know all these people.
Yes, and I ended up with him.
That's funny.
Yes.
Oh, we'll explore that a bit more in a minute.
But there was never anything between him and Olga. It was just a pen friendship, that's all. Yeah.
So he was up in the Canefields, wasn't
yes,
he?
Yes, he was in the Canefields.
Okay, and I'll talk to him about that
yes.
in next time I meet. So on a dare, let's stay with that for a minute. So what are your first impressions when you meet him?
Not bad.
He looked quite handsome.
Yes, yeah, not bad at all. The dare paid off.
So how do you rope? What happens in those days? Like, you go to a movie, you go to dances, of course.
Yeah, a lot of dancing. Before he came, it was the Rivoli at Parramatta. It was the...
So let's just say the name, the Rivoli.
The Rivoli, yes. Well, the Rivoli, that's where the taxation department is now in Parramatta, up on the top of Church Street. And then we went to the Albert Palais in Strathfield. Then we went down to, in town, the big theatres used to be, the Regent and that. Oh. Where we had the balls. I've gone.
It's all right, just be patient with yourself.
Yeah. And also in Leichhardt, I'm trying to think of those two names. But you'd sort of meet up, right, next Saturday we'll meet at there, or the Sunday after that we'll meet there.
Yeah, did you have some photos of your debut?
Yes, I did, and that was at the Rivoli at Parramatta. It was the Catholic coronation ball that they had, and
who was your partner for that?
My brother. Yes, wow. I was still young. I was only 15, so I didn't have any boyfriends or anything like that. But my younger brother was my partner, and we had a big table of all friends and that. But the Rivoli was a huge barn area at that time, and it was chockers, really chock-a-block full for that night, being the coronation and everything, and the official Catholic ball.
Did you have the Horden Pavilion and things like that? Nothing like that?
Yeah, the Horden Pavilion, but that was only used usually during the Easter show. Okay. Nothing very much took over there at all. It was just the Easter time that part of the city came alive.
So how old, you're moving to Casula with your family. How old are you then?
In 1956, I was 19. 19 when we came there. Dad, as I said, had bought the place and was building it, but it wasn't ready. So a friend of his from Leppington, a Mr. Pawpitch, had a house that was empty on Inglemoon Road at Leppington, and we moved in there. My grandmother was with us too. Dad had bought her out, and this cousin that came out with my husband, he was there, and it was only a two-bedroom place. So the boys were, Mum and Dad were in one room, the boys were all in another room, and there was a little veranda out the back that was enclosed, and Bubba and I were in there. We could just sort of walk sideways to get into bed. But happy. Happy, you've got no idea how happy we were.
How did the landscape look then, in 56?
56? Well, when we had the shop in 56 in Liverpool, in Macquarie Street.
So he lived at Casula and bought a shop?
No, when he sold the farm, he had the property in Casula he was building, and we had the shop, a delicatessen in Macquarie Street. Our delicatessen had a wooden pavement out the front sort of thing. Some of the shops had like wood, some of them had dirt, some of them had a concrete patch in front of the shop. But it was all, I mean, you didn't walk down the in front of the shop like you do in Liverpool. It was all the one, there were steps everywhere. You had to sometimes, when it was raining, bypass the muddy areas and it was still a. And across the road, I'm trying to think of a name, they were very, very big. She'd come in every Friday with a horse and cart, and she had the long skirt. She's, I'd say, pre-First World War type of thing, clothing on her. She had a daughter that was backwards. She'd be sitting in the horse and cart, but she'd come down Macquarie Street getting the rents. She was very, very well off. And I've gone blank, and I can't think of a name.
You'll remember when I go.
Yeah. One of the areas... No, not Ashcroft. I'm trying to think. Out to one of the areas in Green Valley,
really?
Named after the family.
Sadlier.
No.
Wickenburg.
No.
Busby, Ashcroft, Miller. Cartwright.
Cartwright. I'm trying to.
Yeah, it's okay.
Yes.
Well, you can mention it.
Yeah. I see the grave down when I go down to the cemetery. I see their headstone, and that. I just can't think at the moment, isn't it?
So they were big landowners.
They were big landowners, and as I said, they owned a lot of shops in Liverpool. And she was the mother, and her daughter were the only ones left of the family. But as I said, she'd come in. There are photos. I know in the Liverpool Bowling Club, there's photos more or less of her there, but. There weren't that many cars around.
No. So what was the name of your delicatessen?
Just a delicatessen that had no special... Everything. Sugar didn't come packed, pre-packed. Sugar came in bags. All the spaghetti pastas and that came in boxes, 22-pound boxes. You had to take them out. Rice came in bags. Butter was, we didn't have margarine, of course, we had butter. There was everything we had to pack there. And my oldest brother was such a softy, instead of putting a pound of sugar in a brown bag, he'd put a pound and at least a couple of ounces. So Dad got him off that. He said, no way. He says, you're not going to be pre-packing anything. You can go out there and serve. But he didn't like the shop, didn't like doing that.
What did you do?
I served. And to tell you the truth, I caught on a lot of Italian at that time. And could with the Italian ladies that came in and didn't speak English, I could talk to them. At least I knew what they were wanting, and that. So,
who were some of your loyal customers? Do you remember any names?
Well, Dominic de Vitoco over here. He and his wife Maria used to come in, and then her sister and her family. A lot of Italians. We had a big clientele of Italians, and we got to know them, and we delivered home. Dad would go and deliver it in the old Holden car to them. So, but we had the shop. We were still living at Blacktown when we first had the shop, so we'd drive along Wargrove Road, Great Western Highway, Wargrove Road, Elizabeth Drive to get here. And then when we moved out here to Leppington, then we were only here for about 6 months, I think. Then Woolworths wanted the had bought the building, but Dad wouldn't allow them to. He wouldn't sell the business. Then they started hounding him, and every offer they gave was less. And he was under terrible stress, so he went off to his solicitor and he says, right, every letter that you write to them, it's up £1,000 from the original that I'm asking. So he went, the solicitor said, Tom, you're mad, you can't do that. He says, yes, I am. He says, you write the letter I'm paying you and you tell them that the price has now gone up £1,000, and every time that you write a letter for me, the price is up £1,000. Woolworths got the letter and paid out the next, signed the contracts the next week. So, but they still diddled Dad by putting a word in the contract that he ended up paying £2,500 tax. So, for that one word.
It's a lot of money in those days.
It was a lot of money. You could have bought a house. Well, the houses in George Street, which were huge houses on huge blocks, were going between £3,000 and £4,000. And today it's they're multi-million dollar properties. So, but anyhow, we got over there. But he had a heart attack because of it all and was very ill after that.
So let's move to when you met your husband. Now we'll talk about that for a bit. Get your version of events.
Right, my version of events.
Because we'll get his.
Like. Yes, and, well, I think we met at the, really at the 29th of November. That was the Yugoslav Republic Day. And they'd always in the city, they'd have a really big do.
We're at in the city, excuse my ignorance.
Well, a lot went out at Paddington Town Hall. We had a lot of shows out at the Jewish Maccabean Hall at Darlinghurst there. My dad was stabbed there in the leg, 1948 I think it was. They put on the New Australians, as they were called then. Put on a big show, and they decided to call the old Yugoslavs that came out before the war. And it was a beautiful night, I can recall that. It was a really terrific night. Had a lot of fun, and they put on a show, you know, stage show and that. It was wonderful. Anyhow, when everything finished, we were outside on the on the footpath. They were talking how good it was and this, that and the other, and this chappie came up and started swearing at us all, around. And my dad went up to him and he says, "Listen, young man," he says, "our women are not used to that sort of language." He says, "Please tone it down, or please leave." He says, "Especially our children, they haven't heard that type of language." It was atrocious. And the next thing, Dad knew that he'd been stabbed in the thigh. And another man came to help him, and he got stabbed in the arm. And my brother, eldest brother, came, and he'd been stabbed right across here, across his stomach. But all he had was a little fine line on his skin because it was winter. He had a suit on, and then he had a waistcoat on. Then he had his shirt and thick singlet on underneath because he got cold very easy. Mum kept him very, very well. And this chappie ran off, and my uncle was running after him, shouting, "Police, police." And he ran straight past Darlinghurst Police Station. The police came out and got him and found everything. Dad was immediately rushed off to St. Vincent's Hospital, and I went with him. Then when he came home, the police kept coming and asking him to press charges. And Dad said, no, he wasn't pressing charges. He says, "They're too close to us here out at Wargrove and that." And although he made a lot of friends, people, they'd walk along the highway and they'd ask, any Yugoslavs living around here? And they told them that Dad was down here, and they used to come in droves. Some of them were really terrific. What they did during the war is their business. But those that were really, some of them just hatred. It was terrible. But anyhow, apparently they sent him back to Yugoslavia. I don't think he did well there when he got back, because they couldn't send him back to Germany. They sent them back for their native country.
Because they were taken, weren't they, to Germany?
Oh no, a lot of them fought with the Germans.
Yeah,
and
they fought with them during the Second World War, they were there.
Yeah.
That's sad, isn't it?
It is,
the Germans took them, didn't they?
And a lot took them, yes.
Yeah.
My husband's, one of his cousins was taken away, never came back.
Labourer or something?
No, not as a labourer. They were taken as some Germans had been killed, and then they'd
replenish the forces.
Not replenish the forces, took them away as what's the word? I'm going nuts. I must be losing my memory. Okay.
Have a stretch.
Yeah.
I don't need a stretch.
So we just
think they were taken away. So caused it. So.
Yeah.
When the enemy takes away.
What's the word starting with T? I've got it in Yugoslav, but I can't think of it.
Well, you can say it in Yugoslav.
Talce. I can't even say Yugoslav anymore.
People that were taken away.
Yeah, people,
the streets.
Just taken
just
and.
Kidnapped.
A type of kidnap. But, they took them away because it was.
Because it's important, this word.
Yeah.
Sorry, I've got to go to
the toilet. Yep, okay. Over there. Just mind the toilet seat.
Yeah, over here?
Yes, okay. Right over there.
So are you right? You need to stretch your legs?
Yeah, I can just... Oh, I'm okay. My foot's resting.
We've probably got another 20, 25 minutes. We're going for an hour and 10 minutes. I'll try to keep them to about an hour and a half.
Yeah.
No more than two.
Yeah.
We'll see how we go.
Yeah.
You're doing really well. That's good. It's amazing how much you've got to try and cover, though, isn't it?
Now I remember one of the clearest memories to me is Mum sent me into Blacktown one Saturday morning to go and do the shopping, and she wanted a straw broom too, a millet broom. So I was carrying, and I was only seven, I went through the bush, and I was carrying the shopping and the broom under the arm, in the teeth, I swept the whole.
Oh, we'll have to get that story down. Now, tea.
Yes, but the seat's broken. That's a story in itself. You know what happened with the seat? You can see, there's a little crack in the seat.
Oh, you were yelling out to me, were you?
Yeah.
Thinking, there's a crack in the seat. Door, I hope she doesn't come in.
Yeah. And also the black one downstairs. There's also a toilet down there with a broken seat. And
I
said to Miles, we've got to get new seats for it. He says, you won't be able to buy them. I said, don't be ridiculous. You can get them anywhere. You know, anyhow, Miles came one day about 3-4 months ago, and I said to him, get the hacksaw and cut it off, because he couldn't undo it all. So he cut it off. Guess what? Can't find the toilet. Says, I've got to either change the whole toilet. We've been all over Sydney. This toilet here and another toilet downstairs. Okay. Yeah, I've got to change the whole lot.
I hope we didn't record that.
I hope not.
Oh, I think we did.
No, go backwards.
Okay, so...
we were, but I'll delete that.
Yeah.
I did have it on pause, but for some reason it...
Oh, good heavens above.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter. I'll delete that.
Yeah. Anyhow, talking...
So that word, can you recall what the word is when they were taken away?
What does an army do when they take away... people. They're a traitor gives away when they so many people for one dead army chap. You know, they take away.
Do they trade them or something?
No.
Can you just explain what happened to me? What did they do?
Well, apparently, a German soldier had been killed. Right, so they took 12 of the village people, men, for the one. Sometimes they kill them, sometimes they took them away. But they're called.
So, who? So it had nothing to do with Yugoslavia, but one of their Germans would be killed somewhere.
Well, this guy, we're talking. When I said before that one of Miles's cousins was taken away and never returned, he was part. A German soldier had been killed in Blatow, in the village. Then they took 12 men, whoever they happened to catch hold of at that time, and took them away. A lot of the times they were killed to show who had the force, who was the boss there, not to do anything. But these 12 were taken away. Most of them ended up in Hungary, up there. But his cousin never ever got practically anywhere. I think he tried to escape, and then he was killed.
Do you know what they did with them? Well, they put them in camps.
They were put in camps. A lot of them were made to fight or stuck them on the front lines or did all sorts of stuff. There's a special word for it. And it just
went
Tauzi. And... isn't it terrible? Now I'm thinking Yugoslav, not English.
So you just mentioned a story about the broom. Let's just tell us. Just tell me that story.
Oh, the broom. I was 7 years old. I can recall that quite well. And I went via Reservoir Road through the bush to Blacktown on a Saturday morning. Mum needed some things. And we didn't have vehicles of any description. Dad usually went on his bike. But I went in and I got what she needed. She wanted a millet broom too, I had to buy. And with both hands full of shopping, the millet broom was part-time under one arm or under the other arm. When it kept slipping out and falling onto the road, then sometimes I got hold of it with my teeth and I was pulling it along. But by the time I got home, I'd swept the whole track. But I got it home.
That's one hell of a task.
It was, yeah.
Do you remember what colour of the broom?
Well, just an ordinary. They're still the same today. There's no difference, except they're a lot cheaper than buying them today.
Okay, so thank you for sharing that. How long did it take you to get it home?
Oh, I think it took me a couple of hours to get home. It didn't take me that. I used to, and at that time, we weren't scared. We weren't scared. I'd walk through the bush by myself as a 7-year-old. I didn't worry about anything. Nothing happened. Mum wasn't scared. The houses were left unlocked. I do recall Mrs. Rubo coming up once and leaving a message on the table that she took some sugar and that she'd bring it back. The house was unlocked. And she brought the sugar back. That was how trustworthy everybody was of each other, until we had a spate of robberies. And now those robberies took place in the 50s. And the police inspector's brother-in-law, he'd tell him who was going to market, who had the money home, and the brother-in-law was breaking in until the CIB at the time, someone... they kept going to Blacktown Police and nothing was happening. So one of the... had been robbed 2 or 3 times, this Maltese gentleman. He had a little more sense and he went off to the CIB in Parramatta. And then they got him that way. But we were never robbed, but...
Except by the police.
But then everybody started locking in the house, and it was a different kettle of fish. And then we had that Graham Thorne abduction and murder, and everyone got scared for the kids. And then you didn't let them out of your sight, and it's just gotten worse as we go along.
Was the delicatessen successful?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was quite, I wouldn't say it was making millions or anything like that, but it was a nice living for Dad. And I worked with him all the time. As a matter of fact, he sent me to a friend's delicatessen in Blacktown for 6 months to learn the business, because my middle brother was a motor mechanic and my oldest brother was a tailor. And
So let's talk about your elder brother and the tailor you mentioned. What are both your brothers' names?
My oldest brother was his Tom, or Ante in Slav, and my other brother was Morris. And Tom was born on the 8th of September 1930, and he'd be 81 nearly this year, but he died at the age of 36. And Maury was born on the 25th of November 1935, and he died at 49. So I've outlived them well and truly.
So let's talk about, how did your brother learn to be a tailor?
Well, because he'd been ill, or was ill most of his life because of the rheumatic fever. He couldn't do physical work. He would have liked to have done like a carpenter or something like that, but he wasn't. And then someone was talking to him one day and he says, well, that sounds all right. And he decided to be a tailor. And Dad got him this apprenticeship with this Mr. Neidorf and Mr. Hillman. I remember their names. And he went to work for them, and they both lived in Bondi Junction, but they had a workroom in the city, I think somewhere in Pitt Street, I can't quite... And we became very, very friendly, or family, more or less. And Tom, well, I think, would have been one of the best dressed if he, wanted to go somewhere special. I've got nothing to wear, worse than any woman. And he'd go and buy the material, come home, and cut himself out a new suit. When he died, I know that Mum packed something like 35 suits in a crate and sent it overseas that were still good. And he was beautifully dressed always, and taught me quite a bit, so that I could, mend, fix, do things. My daughter's in-law is in the rag trade, has done the whole thing, and yet the other weekend she bought a pair of trousers for my son in Hong Kong, and they were a bit tight. Here, you know what to do. You do fix them. So I did that. But all to Tom was really, and he was best man to a number of friends, and his wedding gift was always suits for the wedding party. He made them, and he got very cranky at one friend though, because he kept bringing suit back and say he says, "Well, why? First of all, you put on weight, then you lose weight, then you put on weight." He says, "What do you expect me to do?"
So when you say your mum sent suits back to Croatia, what sort of links did you keep up with your homeland?
Oh, she still had a brother and a sister over there. No, the sister, brother-in-law, the sister had died by that time. A brother and his family and that, and just to have a, I mean, they were too good, not to do something with them, and they went over, and whoever, friends, and gave them, because they weren't doing well either, so they doled them out to relations there or whatever it was. And
So, well, I don't know where to go from here. I've got to get you to stop moving your feet because it's coming through on the mic, believe it or not. I'll let it go for a bit. I thought I'll just say something. I have to get people to stop tapping a lot too. They tap the table.
oh, right.
You do things, don't
Yeah.
you? You just fidget.
You're trying to think.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, where would you like to go from here? Now, we haven't. Let's talk about where you got married. How long
Right.
were you? How long did you go out with hubby before you married him?
Well, we were engaged for 2 years, and we were going together for 5 years before that.
Very sensible.
Very sensible. I still don't know whether I made the right choice, if I was still too early, but no, a bit of a joke. But no, we got married at the Catholic Church in Cabramatta, because they were building the new church here at Liverpool at the time, and the old one was in a bit of a mess, where Westfields are now. And then we got married there. We were living with Mum and Dad at Casula for a while. Then we built a house in Thelma Street in Liverpool, and we lived there for not very long, because then my eldest brother passed away, and Mum and Dad were really comatose, really, for a long time. And Miles said that the best thing to do would be to sell up, and for me to go back home. We'd go back home to Mum and Dad's, and I'd take care of them and my grandmother. So there were three of them that were really in a bad way. And with the two kids, we did that. And Dad had earlier on had built a lovely two-bedroom little place at the back, a little unit. So we had plenty of room. And he even, when the boys got a bit bigger, he even did it, made an inside bathroom, toilet, did every, they were wonder, they thought they were in heaven, that they weren't living in the house with Mum and Dad. But Dad, then in 1969, we decided together, but Miles was feeling very, very homesick. And we decided we'd go and visit his mother. But he'd never met his sister. He'd met her, but as a small child, she'd gone off to Argentina when he was only three. He couldn't recall her at all. She was 18 years older than he was. So we went by ship via Cape Horn to Argentina, spent a couple of months there, met a lot of his relations there, and then flew to Italy and bought a car, and then went to Yugoslavia and met everyone. I met a lot of my relations and a lot of his relations, and we had just the two children at the time, the oldest. Had a wonderful time, and we were going to stay a year. We were gone for about 10 months when my brother rang to say that Dad had died. So we quickly, it took us so many days to get back to Sydney. We were all over the place. Qantas was very good. They'd ring up Morris and tell him now they're in Rome, now they're in Tehran, now they're in New Delhi, now they're in Hong Kong, now they're in Manila. But we'll get them here. I got here 2 hours before the funeral. Then I really had Mum and Bubba, and Bubba had gone completely senile after an operation. It was pretty hard.
So you've spent a lot of your life caring as
yes,
a carer.
Yes. I cared for Mum for well over 20 odd years. And Bubba lived for 4 years. She was terrible. But she went into hospital 2 days before she died. Otherwise she was at home all the time. I didn't put her in a home or anywhere else like that. And this is what, when Mum had her series of strokes, I'd have kept looking after her. But then the Liverpool Hospital pulled me in one day and they had a really good talk to me and said to that they couldn't allow Mum to come back home to me. She says because in a very short time she pointed upstairs, which was Macquarie Clinic for the people with mental problems. He said you'd be up there, and not only that, but if you'd insist on Mum coming home, then we will not take her back into hospital when she has another bad turn or whatever it is. So I had to put her in a home. I kept my grandmother home, but I couldn't keep my mum home. But she was only in a home for 8 months, thank God, and died peacefully.
Did what you could.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Every day I was with her. Every day I took a lunch. Yeah, I cooked lunch. I'd get up early in the morning and do the washing or ironing or cleaning and half the cooking, and I'd be out there by 10 o'clock and stay there until 5 o'clock and then come home and finish the...
And what was that like? Maybe?
Hell.
God.
I lost a lot of weight, but that was the only good thing to it. Was the losing of the weight, but otherwise, no. Well, I'm not unhappy that I didn't do it. I'm quite.
No, of course, yes. But it's an incredible contribution, isn't it?
Yes,
it's a beautiful thing. Of course, yes. It's so selfless.
Yes,
but incredibly, I just got.
Yeah, and I had, as I said, I had Mum. She'd had a series of heart attacks after Dad died. Then I had Bubba with the completely senile, completely. The two kids, then Miles's business, which I ran for him. I did all the buying, all the shopping. I didn't at first even have a sit-down lawnmower, but I cut a couple of acres of grass with the push lawnmower. And I still did it all and could keep going.
Just one of those amazing people, hey?
I wouldn't say I was amazing. It was just something
skills.
That you had to do it. Yes, because I mean, well, he didn't when he came here. That's why a lot of the married people, met us, and they
right.
They got the lottery.
Exactly.
You had Katie and Jesse, and that knew the English, could write and read and do everything. You know, my husband still doesn't go to the bank. He has no idea what goes on at the bank. He doesn't pay a bill. He has no ideas.
So you would have met a lot of people through his business.
I've met a lot of people through
his
business.
Let's talk about some of those people. Like,
Oh, he can talk to you because there are so many funny episodes.
Yeah.
They're hilarious of what they used to do to each other on the jobs.
Yeah. So some of the big builders in this community, a lot of the men went into building, didn't they?
Yes.
Like Croatian men.
Yes, yeah. But a lot of them, Miles with Ivan Puderich, did a lot of private work. And then when the housing commission started, it was hard, but it was a lot easier work. And it was dead set certain that you'd get paid for the amount of work you did. And you worked hard, but you in the end result is what you were working for money, you got the money. And they decided it was better working on the commission than doing private homes at that time. Anyhow, there weren't many big builders. I think the only builder at the time that was going on was the Marler Homes and Gavin and Shalala. I can remember those. They were doing houses, but you didn't find like Masterton or Meriton or any. They still
Mervac.
Haven't. Yeah, Mervac. They still haven't come out.
So
type
you,
of thing.
You were doing his ordering and stuff because of the English?
Yes, because of the English and that. I mean, he did the housing, he didn't have to order on the housing commission, that came pre-packed. Not at first. At first he had to cut the frames. And I think, one of the rare breed that has papers to say that he'd finished his course, because Dad made him go to East Sydney Technical College, and Dad was his interpreter. And they'd ask him these questions, and he had to do this and do that, you know, cut things and do things there, and then he got his papers. And he was one of the very, I would say, one of the rarest on the housing commission that had papers to state that he'd done the trade. And when he started working for A.V. Jennings, he did all the show homes. And that, because of he had to cut the frames and the roof and do everything else from plan. And
I'm just wondering where we go sort of for the next 10 minutes.
Right.
Like who were some of your closest friends? Like some of the women that really you connected with in the community.
Oh, well,
is
yeah.
it all of them, or is...
Well, even today, I'm still friends up at the club with a lot of them. I've still got a lot of them, a lot of friends that are out. We're on the phone. It's not once we had children, we didn't meet up as often. Everybody had their own thing to do. You had your husband, you had your cooking. You weren't single anymore. You couldn't go where you wanted to. Then the children came. Then it was the school. Then it was the children. Friends, we sort of got further away, but we're on the phone. First of all, it'd be quite constant, and then it'd be once a month sort of thing, and then maybe once every 6 months. But even to today, we still ring and get you know up to date on everything that's going on, and we do sometimes meet. Last year in March, we quite a lot of us met in a hotel above Myers at in George Street, Liverpool. We had lunch in there and we had beard time. We were going to do it this year, but we haven't done it so far. And we'll do things like that. And now, last November, we had a reunion at Blacktown. At the Blacktown Workers Club, there must have been 150 of us with families. And I reminded the organisers of one lady. They'd completely forgot that she was even in Blacktown at that time. And got in touch with her, and she hadn't been in touch with anyone for 50 years. Now we are on the phone quite often. Speaking to each other, we do things like that to be able to get. And then, of course, nowadays, I mean, when we were younger, there were 21 birthdays or 30 birthdays or 40 birthdays. I mean, last year I went to a 100th birthday. couple of weeks ago, I went to an 80th birthday. On Sunday, I went to an 89th birthday. The age difference is different. And we meet at weddings, if you're invited, but definitely at funerals. Out of respect, we go to each friend's or family, you know, of theirs, and you catch up. You catch up.
So how do you spend your days these days?
Still plenty to do. As you see, I've got a bit of a larger home and
a large bathroom.
Well, there are three of them. Then with these gum trees, they're always shedding. It doesn't matter what it is, broken branches, cleaning up before he goes on the sit-down lawnmower and cuts the lawn, the 5 acres of lawn. There's a huge pool at the back, never-ending work, except in winter when we let it go. I cook. We still have a few visitors, you know, we go visit, they come visit. Then, of course, there's the children, the grandchildren, all holidays, they're here. Or long weekends, they're here. At one stage there, when the last one was leaving home, I cried and cried. And now I cry when they say they're all coming back.
So you're on 5 acres here?
Yes.
So no wonder the kids love coming here.
They do. They absolutely love it. Really, really love it. And they've got one of the garages over there is full of bikes and cricket paraphernalia, footballs.
So what about your sporting career? Were you an athletic person?
Yes, I did tennis at school and, of course, athletics. Played basketball after school, and then I did a lot of umpiring for the Catholic youth of a Saturday, and that was about it. Then.
So your athletics did take you beyond school, or
just after school was with the basketball, and then the umpiring. Yeah, I did that. So.
What about the bocce club? How do you feel about the bocce club?
I love it. I love it. To tell you the truth, I get quite upset with Miles that he doesn't go on a Friday afternoon anymore, because that's the only time I can get Foxtel to myself. And he goes Saturdays and he goes Sundays, and I tell him not to come home for dinner because I don't want to cook, to stay up there. And he was up there he really bought the club to where it is, because a lot of them gave up, went off to green bowls, and he'd go up every Sunday and open it up and stay there even if no one came for many, many years. I think he was in the committee for about 40 years. And
it's great for you to see the women there.
Yes,
How do you feel about the women? Like, how do you relate? They're lucky because you're
good. Good, because we've had mostly the same sort of upbringing. We all had it hard when we were young. We didn't have money to throw around, and we didn't have. I know Mum used to give me a halfpenny, half a penny a day to go to, and I could buy a little ice cream at the shop at Blacktown. Not that I needed it, because I had ice creams at home, but your friends bought them, so you wanted to be school friends. You know, you wanted to be with them. And I know that she had a lovely old pillar box English. Postal pillar box, money box, and she used to put in her money there that she was going to buy me a coat when she had a few pennies or sixpence or threepence left over. And Maurie and I opened the bottom of it and took all the money, and he had a complete army, air force and flotilla of little lead soldiers during the war, and Mum didn't know where it was coming from until one day she said, I should have enough money here, I'll go and buy that coat. And there was nothing in the pillar box. So
you were no angel?
No. No, definitely not. No, and I was no girly girl either when I was younger. I was very, very... I wanted to be better than the boys. And that in running. And I've got to tell you this story. Dad paid, my school fees were 99 guineas a year, 33 guineas a term. Then I had the violin on top of that. And then on top of that, we didn't have free train travel. He had to pay £25 for a metal ticket, which I had on a bangle a year. And we were down in Parramatta Park. We went to do some sport. There was a show going on from school. Some other Catholic schools were there too. It was an athletics type of show. And when it was time to go home, I looked and my train ticket wasn't there. And I started crying, of course. £25, Dad can't afford that. He did everything, as I said, to give us good schooling. And and I started crying, and Sister came over. I think it was Sister Barbara. She came over and she wanted to know what it was, and I told her what was happening, and she couldn't calm me down at all. And she said, right, let's just kneel here and we'll say a prayer to St. Anthony to help us find your ticket. Because I'd been looking everywhere, you know. And we knelt down and we said a number of prayers. I can't recall what they were. Just something to St. Anthony. And when I got up, we got up and I was still, as I said, crying. And she was trying to pat me on the back and saying things would be all right and that. And the sun shone on something where I'd been kneeling. I saw it, and there was my ticket. Whether it was St. Anthony or something, but I always say something put it there that day. And even to today, it's a miracle.
Do you still say your prayers?
On occasion, yeah. When the kids are with me, I make them say the Angel of God prayer before they fall asleep. They've never learned that. Even though Christina was going to a Catholic school, she said, I've never heard that one, Baba. Never heard, so I say, you know, because I say it at night.
And so they call you Baba, like your grandmother?
Yes.
What, does Baba mean anything? Or?
Baba means nonna, grandma. Babushka. So I'm Baba and he's Didda. When the boys got married, my daughters-in-law said, what are we going to call you? I says, call me Frances until I'm Bubba. And then when I'm Bubba, I'm Bubba. Yeah.
It's the 2nd of August at 2 Dixon Road.
Denham Court.
And Frances Pektovich, who I interviewed recently for the Pioneers of the Fringe project, is just wanting to add a few things to her interview. So,
how are you today?
Well, the weather's turned, it's beautiful, and I'm quite happy. I just wanted to say a few things that I'd forgotten. When we first came to the farm at Blacktown, there was an old rubbish tip in not far away, and the first boots that Dad had on the farm were made out of old tyres and bags. He'd make holes in the tyre, and then Mum would sew bags around until they could afford to buy boots, the Wellingtons. And also Mum would go down there and find old clothes to wear on the farm at the time. I have to tell a little bit just about my grandparents. My great-great-grandfathers from both sides came to Australia in the 1860s. They were at Kalgoorlie and they were at Ballarat. They followed the gold fields. They also went to California and to Alaska.
What were their names?
Castellan and Kurak. Marine Castellan and Anton Kurak. Those days, they couldn't afford to live at home economically. It was terrible. So they'd go out into the world for a few years. They'd come back home to the Dalmatian coast, which was Austro-Hungarian. And they'd build on another window to the house and leave their wife pregnant and off again. That's why they had so many kids. And my grandparents also came to Australia. Dad's father, Anton, he came only for the gold. But Mum's dad, Marine, came also for the gold, but then during the after the Great War, he came out again and he went to work in Kalgoorlie. Wasn't anything to do. So he started walking to Cairns. And he walked the whole area to Cairns. He'd stop off at the farms, and at that time you could kill a sheep so long as you skinned it properly and left the skin over the fence. It didn't matter what you did. And he got to Cairns, and he was supposed to give them £10 as a guarantee. And he said, if I had £10, I wouldn't have walked from Kalgoorlie. But another gentleman lent it to him. His brother, in earlier days, came to Kalgoorlie too, and during the miners' strike, he was working. And the miners thought he was a scab, but he wasn't. He was a guard on one of the shafts. And they got hold of him and threw him down a shaft and killed him. He was only in his 20s. That's Mum's uncle. And that's, I think, about it. And I do remember the name of the lady in Liverpool. It's very in the history books of Liverpool, is Edith Bull. That used to come when we had the shop every Friday in her horse and sulky with her, she had a daughter that was mentally mentally and physically disabled, and it was quite interesting to see her in her old big old skirts that they wore pre-First World War. And that's about it.
There's another bull I met, and he's a man. I don't know whether he's any relation to her.
I don't know, but she used to come with her daughter. But as I said, at that time, practically half of Macquarie Street was theirs, and she'd come and collect the rents every Friday. Just something.
What was she like?
She was a big, cumbersome type of a lady. I would say that she's bigger than what I am now. I mean, at that time I was a young, slim lady, a young girl. But I think the clothing made her. It's just all I could think of now is that you get a piece of material and you sew up the sides and you put elastic around the top. That was her skirt. No shape or anything to it.
Now, there was a word you were thinking of that you were...
Hostages. Yes. Hostage. My dad's sister was a hostage. And when the Germans were in Yugoslavia at the time. And she was taken as a hostage, 12 of them all together. Some German officer had been killed. And they were all tied together by wire and taken out into the channel between the island and the mainland and thrown into the water. So that's all we know how she died.
So who was she again?
She was my father's half-sister, because Dad became... his mother died when he was 8 months old.
How do you reconcile that when that happens to you? Like, what impact did that have?
Oh, he didn't spend that much time with her, because his father remarried, and then he had this half-sister, and then his father died from the lung disease that he got in the mines as a young man, and Dad, I think, was about 4 or 5 when his father died and lived with his grandfather for another 2 years, whereas his stepmother went to live with her family and took the daughter. So they were sort of in the same village, and they were friends, but they weren't brother and sister type of thing. They didn't grow up as brother and sister, close together.
Is that it for you?
That's it, I think so, yeah.